ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Nightlife. News breakdown.
Well, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese was in Gladstone today announcing a multi-million dollar loan to boost a critical mineral project in central Queensland. Australia's first high-purity alumina processing facility in Gladstone will receive a $400 million loan. The project will allow Australia to process alumina, commonly used in electric car batteries and superconductors. And as the Prime Minister told ABC Capricornia, the investment is going to generate jobs.
What that means is 490 jobs during construction, but over 200 jobs ongoing. We need to make sure that we value add wherever possible here, that we make more things here.
Well, the announcement comes after last week's release, of course, of the Prime Minister's Future Made in Australia plan, which aims to promote local manufacturing and safeguard the nation's control over resources and critical minerals. And there are concerns that such new ventures, though, might end up just being reliant on survival with government funding. Joining us for Nightlife's News Breakdown tonight is Jennifer Hewitt, National Affairs columnist with the Financial Review. Jennifer, good evening. Welcome back to Nightlife.
Thank you.
You've got an interesting piece in the Fin today focusing on Australia's critical mineral strategy and a new report from ASPI, the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, on how the nation is selling itself and its allies short in the critical minerals realm. How so?
Well, part of it is because they point out that Australia's, you know, talks a lot about critical mineral supply chains and how important they are, but doesn't really have any grip on what all these Australian companies are doing offshore as well, and that is a very important part of trying to develop reliable supply chains. And that also, for example, Canada, you know, knows exactly what it does, kind of works closely with industry on that. But I think it goes to a broader point, which is that everybody's a bit confused about the rhetoric of self-sufficiency made in the future and exactly how do we get there that doesn't rely on subsidies to businesses, to individual businesses that may or may not be successful. And that is a kind of an open question, I think. The government basically says this is actually what we need to do, and that's the only way we can compete with countries like the US and Europe who are subsidising their manufacturing. There are plenty of economists say, well, that's fine, but you could be very, very careful about who you subsidise and where Australia has kind of comparative advantage or not. And there is an argument that, for example, they gave a lot of solar money to solar panel making in the Hunter Valley a couple of weeks ago, again, with this pretext and the whole, of course, the emphasis on jobs, except that really, you know, does it really make much sense for Australia to make solar panels? And in fact, are we better off to do some preliminary processing, but not have these fantasies about being able to do electric batteries and in the same way that we did cars, for example?
Exactly. It is a path which Australia has been down many times, and it's a debate we've had many times. Tell me about critical minerals. What are we talking about here, and where's Australia's place in the critical mineral supply scheme?
Well, Australia is actually very important, along with Canada. It's really one of the two top developing economies that have abundant supplies of critical minerals. Of course, critical minerals is in many ways a political kind of construct because everybody's got a different list
of what's critical.
But I mean, in general, you know, there are all sorts of minerals that, you know, particularly the ones that go to renewable energy and green technology and advanced defence technology, you know, everything basically from mobile phones to wind turbines, you know, they're very, very important, increasingly so. And what we did, or what Western economies did over a very long period of time was kind of basic, with the exception of Australia, which has always been a big mining country, is basically say, oh, well, that's fine, we can just let, you know, somebody else do that and we'll just take the finished products. And, of course, that attitude is changing.
I know it's changing, Jen, but what downstream processing of minerals and, elaborate transformation of minerals has been a debate in Australia since the year dot, hasn't it? We've never managed to do much very successfully. Why is it any different now?
Well, of course, that's the big question, and I don't know that it is that different. Yeah. I mean, Australia is very good, very efficient in mining, but even so, you know, from it takes a mine in Australia an average 15 years to go from discovery to actual production, and that's only getting kind of harder and longer. So that's difficult enough, and then you go on to the very different skills that you need in manufacturing. Plus, you know, Australia is a very high cost country. Mm. So we need to have particular advantages that we can do it better. Now, they'll say, oh, well, that's because we're close to the resource and, you know, therefore it'll be easier. Well, that has not been the case in the past. It hasn't worked like that at all.
It certainly hasn't. I know. Look, made in Australia sounds terrific. And it's always
a great slogan.
It's a great slogan, and everyone wants it to happen. But the structural issues that made it, you know, that have made it fail in the past, the collapse of the car industry, don't seem to have gone away, do they?
Well, I remember Kevin Rudd when he came to office. That was in, wasn't it, 2007? How long ago is that? Quite a while. A quarter of a century going, I want Australia be a place that makes things, and everybody goes, yeah, and that's all great, but you know,
well, we're all in favour of that, but I mean, yes, but what and how?
Yes.
Yeah, look, it does. I mean, one of the concerning things about all of this, I suppose, is the worry that, and maybe this is the case worldwide, that we're heading back into a new age of protectionism, are we?
Oh, well, I think that's certainly the case. I mean, Jim Chalmers is very keen to say, oh, no, this is not about building walls. This is about building foundations, which, of course, is one of those, another nice slogan. But I don't think there's any doubt that, you know, much of the world is going to kind of greater protection. Now, Australia can actually have a role in that, in the sense that, for example, the US is very keen to import less from China and to disengage a bit from China, and that means that countries like Australia would have an advantage in some way, in many ways, of kind of saying, well, look, we can provide certain minerals and things. But again, if we wanted to compete with America or the Europe in offering subsidies, I mean, it's just a kind of losing game, I think.
Yep. Look, on to another issue, the tensions in Iran, and also the announcement this week of increases in Australian defence spending. The US has announced that it will impose new sanctions on Iran as punishment for its weekend attack on Israel. The planned sanctions will target Iran's missile and drone programs and other entities which support Iran's military groups. The US President Joe Biden, however, has told the Israeli leader, Benjamin Netanyahu, that they won't support any military response to the drone strike. That doesn't mean the Israeli cabinet will decide not to do that. They're still weighing their options. You've written about these latest developments and notably Iran's move to open confrontation with Israel rather than the continued use of its proxies as something of a game changer. Is it? Are we heading towards open hostility? And, well, there's plenty of covert hostility. Are we talking about open warfare between Iran and Israel?
Well, that's the big uncertainty, isn't it? I mean, until now, I think Iran has been very, very reluctant to engage in that kind of open warfare. It has relied on its proxies in other countries, neighbouring countries. And so I think this is a change. It also depends what Israel does in response. I mean, it is true, however, that Iran was very, you know, it announced at the beginning and then it said the end. So there's this kind of awful game of chess going on, but with, you know, very, very bloody results, obviously, or can be very bloody results. But I don't think there's any doubt that Israel will respond in some way, but it's a question of the timing of that, but also how limited or kind of symbolic it is.
Yeah, true. It coincides with this announcement of an increase in defence spending. The government's announced they'll spend another $50 billion over the next decade, with an immediate boost of more than $1 billion to accelerate long-range missiles as well as other lethal autonomous systems, whatever they are. Speaking at the National Press Club, Defence Minister Richard Marles outlined the overall financial changes.
These increases will see annual defence spending almost double over the next 10 years to $100 billion in the financial year 33-34. It will see defence spending as a proportion of gross domestic product projected to increase to around 2.4% by 2033-34.
These are big chunks of taxpayer dollars, aren't they, Jennifer? Is 2.4% of GDP on defence spending about where we should be, do you think?
Well, I think it's obvious that Australia's defence spending has to go up. But what you can be very certain of is that Richard Marles will not be the defence minister in 10 years' time. And that, of course, is the slight contradiction, not more than a slight contradiction here, that you're saying, look, we're facing the most dangerous kind of condition, strategic environment since the end of World War II, and therefore we're going to spend a lot more money, but actually we're going to spend it a lot more money towards the end of the decade. Now, look, there's nothing wrong with kind of long-term planning and things, but I just think that the idea of being able to say we're not going to actually kind of do much to upgrade our systems now, yeah, bits and pieces, but we're not going to do that much because we're going to do this transformational, all these new projects, all these new platforms, all these new ships, and they'll take, and not to mention the submarines, of course, that'll take a very, very long time. But don't you worry, we're increasing our defence budget.
It all feels sort of like so much blather, really, doesn't it? Because it's all so far down the track. We're not getting anything for the spending at the moment. And as we know, unfortunately, Australia's defence forces can't even staff themselves at the moment. There are no people to use all the things that this money would be buying, even if the things that we are buying were ever available in the medium term. It's become, of course, a matter of political football between the government and the opposition. The opposition saying, well, we don't think you're doing enough. We're not doing enough. The budget boost announced today, as I say, would bring total defence spending to 2.4% of GDP in 10 years. But Shadow Defence Minister Andrew Hastie says, well, that's not enough.
Under the Albanese government, the ADF will be worse off. There won't be a balanced force or a focused force. There will instead be a weaker force.
Yeah, I know.
And I think one of the other issues has been, you know, as we've seen what's happening in the Middle East, I mean, it is very effective for even, you know, small groups, let alone small countries, but really, you know, lots of militia groups, really, to get hold of armed drones and do a lot of damage that way. So we don't even really seem to be doing much of that at all. We're investing in that, but we are investing in these kind of giant projects which are miles off. And the other thing is that our whole defence record of delivering projects on time, on budget, or even choosing the right projects is just
woeful.
Dismal.
Yes, exactly. Look, on to a matter of more immediate concern, speaking of global concerns, economic and otherwise, we're a month away from the federal budget. Federal Treasurer Jim Chalmers says global conditions will have a big influence on it. He's off to Washington for meetings with central bank governors and counterparts. I'm not sure what he's likely to hear there. He says it'll give him a more direct indication of global economic volatility.
We've got inflation lingering in parts of the world. We've got growth slowing in China and elsewhere. We've got tensions rising in the Middle East and a war in Europe. We've got supply chains which are straining, and we've got a global economy which is fragmenting and transforming. And so all of these factors are really important to us as we finalise the government's third budget. These global conditions are going to be a really big influence on our budget.
Yeah, I'm sure that's right. I mean, it's never an easy job formulating these things, even though the things you formulate don't always turn out to happen. But what do you think is likely to have the biggest impact on the budget over the next month?
Well, it's a very, very cheery outlook, isn't it? all sorts of things that can go wrong, you know, take your pick. I mean, I guess one of the things that's interesting, if you compare it to even a couple of months ago, in the economic outlook, people were much more confident that the, you know, interest rates would come down, that we'd kind of managed this, you know, soft landing, that inflation was falling. And all of a sudden, there are all these kind of roadblocks in there as well. And of course, the backdrop of that is the war in Ukraine, which people have kind of, in a shocking and terrible way, had almost gotten used to. But that is actually kind of, the Ukraine situation is definitely deteriorating. And then you've got the complete volatility of what's happening and risks of what's happening in the Middle East. At the same time, domestically, you've got this inflation that's obviously kind of hanging around. We're going to have the unemployment rate out tomorrow. You know, what is that going to show in terms of jobs? That'll affect the budget as well. And, you know, what the government's messaging is on that, but it'll also affect the Reserve Bank. I mean, the government was very confident, I think, that interest rates would begin to fall kind of quite neatly and the economy would continue to flourish and everything would be okay. But it's looking quite a lot tougher now.
Mm. It certainly is.
But however, what the budget has been saved for, and I think will continue to be saved by, is iron ore prices. And, you know, nobody, the government, nobody likes to pay too much attention to that. But the prices are always well above what Treasury estimates, and that does give them a very, very handy buffer as long as China continues to grow.
And after all, iron ore is made in Australia too, isn't it, Jennifer?
So that is. There's definitely a future made in Australia.
There you are. Always good to talk, Jen.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.